Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard, and today we've got a good one. This show is going to be really, really great. But before I get into today's guest, I want to share something pretty deep and pretty disturbing with you. Because I feel like I can talk to you guys, right? We're friends. We're acquaintances, at least. So engage your empathy a little bit, if you would. I've never heard anybody have this conversation before. And so I kind of want to hear back from as many of you as possible to see if this is, I don't know, something universal or if it's just me. So here goes. Once in a while, a memory will come into my mind, and it can be a memory of anything. Making snowmen when I was a little kid, playing the House of Blues in Chicago, going to work and seeing a balloon stuck in a corner. You know, it can be anything, literally anything. And once in a while, that memory comes with a little tag. And that tag is the thought that I've lived a very long life. I've done enough. And right now at this point, I'm just running out the clock. Because I've done everything that I could hope to accomplish that's of any value. And that's not to devalue myself as a human being. It's just to say, hey, you've done it all. You've traveled the world. You've done all kinds of things. You've been in movies. You've been in bands. You put out records. You've made a podcast. All of these things. It's not about how well any of those things did, because Lord knows I don't really know how to manage any of that. But to me, the making of things, the creation of things really matters. I mean, what else are you going to do with your time? I want to write my cave paintings on the wall. You know, that's what I want to do. When I'm gone, I want them to be there for as long as they're going to be there. I can't really think of anything more noble to do with my existence, considering I'm not really sure how valuable the rest of my existence is, waking up and going to work, having some coffee, plugging in some numbers, you know, stuff like that. And I get these thoughts. You've done enough. You've done enough. You can feel good about all of this. And you know what? Good for you. You worked hard. You got some things accomplished. Maybe not everything you set out to do, but you did some things. Is that weird? It is weird. It's not anything I intend to act on at all. But it's one of those little thoughts that likes to come into my head. Tell me if you've got that thought too, or if I'm nuts. Speaking of things that I do to fight off the ever-encroaching darkness, I will be performing at the Buntport Theater as a part of the We Still Like You show in Denver, Colorado, this Monday, the 21st of October. There's still some tickets available. I would love to see your smiling face. And listen to me tell a story that's so shameful, I will not tell it on this show. But now, we're about to get into the meat of a very substantial conversation. And I cannot thank this guy enough for coming in and delivering such a powerhouse of a talk. Ladies and gentlemen, you are lucky enough to hear my conversation with Tyson Lawrence.
However you want to do this, you just tell me and I'll roll along on with you.
Great. Then, yeah, let's do it like this. We'll just start.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
sounds good.
Right out of the gate. Hi. How you doing?
Doing great, Chris. Doing great.
That's good. Where are you out of right now?
So, currently, I'm in Pleasanton, California, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Nice. It's beautiful there.
Yes, we're very lucky. We've got great weather, and it goes from like spring to summer, summer to spring. We don't get much variation in the weather, but it's definitely nice.
Yeah, but that's the thing that people always forget about the Bay Area is that it's, you know, it can get really cold at night. You know, that fog right. rolls in, but it's an absolutely beautiful area. I haven't been there for probably 2 years and, looking to remedy that as soon as I can.
Yeah, it's, you know, the best time is usually come in the, you know, early spring. So I'm inland, so we get a lot of the heat more so, but you could go 20 miles from where we're at, 10 miles from where we're at, and it'll drop 40 degrees. It's crazy. You got these little, what they call microclimates around here. So it's, you know, but in the springtime, the hills are all green from the rain that we do get in the winter. And, you know, it's really pretty. I'm originally from the Northwest. And I came down here about 20 years ago and just married a California girl and never left.
Whereabouts in the Northwest?
So I grew up in a town called Kennewick, Washington in the Tri-Cities. It's actually in the desert part of Washington State. Not a lot of people know that, but on the eastern part of the state, it's real, it's not the green evergreens that you think of. You know, that's more western Washington, the Seattle area. And whatnot, but it's a great place to grow up. I just after I graduated from college in what was it, 2000, I decided to you know, take a leap, and I got hired by a company that brought me down to the Bay Area. And you know, as long as I'm on the West Coast, I'm all right. I'm a West Coast boy.
Yeah, it's definitely a different kind of area. You know, people can say that different places don't really have a very different personality, but I would completely disagree with that.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, no, I agree with you. Yeah, you're right.
So, I mean, what kind of kid were you?
Well, you know, a football nut. I grew up in a football family. You know, my father had played football in college and was a football official in high school and college, and my mom was, and then he did, he was a budget analyst, financial analyst for a large company that was a government contractor. And my mom was a school teacher, elementary school teacher. And, you know, I just grew up a real sporting family, and it was a lot of fun. We were busy, always traveling, moving around, you know, to different things. And so I pretty much, you know, I grew up following my dad around to football fields and things like that.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm a big football nut.
Nice. So that was, so when about did you leave there?
So I left after college in 2000. I went to Washington State University and graduated and just, I got a job. It was right at the end of the, right about the first dot-com boom. And the early or late 90s,
yeah.
Early 2000s. Yeah. And so I came down here about, there was jobs all over the place in the Northwest because there, you know, there was a lot of technology stuff, you know, kicking off up there and whatnot. And there was a lot of that down here in the Bay Area too. And I didn't end up with a tech firm, but there was just a lot of jobs in general available. So I got hired by a logistics company, and I had no idea what I was going to be doing, but I was moved, they were going to move me to California, and I was young and single, and I said, I was up for it. I'd never been anywhere other than, I mean, I'd never lived anywhere other than Eastern Washington. So it was a good change. It was fun.
Yeah, and taking a chance on something like that. I mean, it seems like it was a pretty calculated risk.
Yeah, you know, it was.
I mean, they were offering to pay you.
Right, right.
So, I mean, that exactly. Minimizes the fear a little bit.
For sure, for sure. And, it wasn't too far from home. Like I said, it was, 2-hour plane flight, so it wasn't going all the way across the country or anything like that. But and it got me out of town, and I kind of got to, build my own life, and just didn't have a lot of prying eyes and people, kind of, just chiming in to what I was doing and whatnot.
Did you have brothers and sisters growing up, or just you?
A younger sister. Mm-hmm. A younger sister. She was about 4 years younger than me. So, she's still up in the Northwest. My mom's up there, and then my father had passed away, and right after I graduated from high school, he took his own life, and was kind of really where it things changed right after high school for sure, big time.
Yeah. What was the community reaction to that like?
It was overall, it was supportive. It was interesting. There was a lot of different ways people reached out, and it kind of. My dad had grown up as in the Catholic Church, and we noticed, when we went to kind of get people for his. To do his funeral, having been that he took his own life, they resisted that because it was such a sin, so to speak. And in that religion. So, I mean, that was one thing. He was very popular in the community. He was a real well known, there's 50,000 people in Kennewick where I grew up, but there was about 150,000 in the whole surrounding region. And, He it wasn't a big area, but it was big enough where, people talk, things, rumors started, rumors spread and things like that. And so, it was a little, people overall were very supportive and helpful, and they lifted me up and my family up and things like that. But there was also kind of this undercurrent of questioning, and with suicide, there's that.
Yeah.
Where people have questions and rumors get started, and, I was real close to my dad, and I was just graduating from high school, and everyone was kind of like, well, what's he going to do? How's he going to react to this? So I felt a lot of pressure also.
Well, yeah. So you were what, 16, 17?
I was 17. I was a week away from my 18th birthday.
Yeah.
It was a week after I graduated from high school, and it was the day after Father's Day.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, it was Monday morning. So, and I was in Mazatlan, Mexico on my high school graduation trip. And I got the news and I came back home and, I flew into the small town there. And then on the front page the next morning, there was people all over the house and things like that with friends and family and stuff like that were over there. It had just happened the day before. So they were there consoling us, everything like that. And then, the next morning there was a front page article in the sports section of the newspaper kind of, talking about it. So it was kind of, it was a real surreal time,
What was your relationship with grief leading up to that? Was that something that your family had really ever had to go through as far as, a serious loss?
My grandfather, my opa, had died suddenly my sophomore year, but it was a little different. I mean, obviously it was a lot different, but this was my first real like kicking the balls type of grief.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's apparent. There's no comparison. Yeah.
No. No, and you know, he was my role model and my, you know, best friend growing up, and we were buddies, and nobody saw it coming. I mean, I don't know if a lot of people do all the time when it comes to suicide, but you know, it was a real shocker to everybody. He's a very positive, outgoing, upbeat person, and so it just was one of those things where it really took the wind out of everybody.
Yeah,
everybody.
So what was your path forward on something like that? Because I mean that's got to be one of the most difficult things a person can manage.
Yeah, you know, and especially at that time.
Yeah,
in my life, it was you know, I have vivid memory of when I found out in the hotel room, and you know, I just needed to get some air, and I left, and I walked down to the beach, and I was staring out at the Pacific Ocean, and I just remember thinking, like trying to make sense of it. Just what is my path forward? I was trying to figure out my path forward just general in life.
Right.
And now here my biggest mentor, my biggest, you know, source of, you know, support, you know, was gone. And so I wasn't going to be able to rely on that for the next few years when it's really critical. And even when I got home to figure out what I was going to do with college and all that stuff. And so I remember looking out there and I having a discussion thinking, okay, you know, I can either let this tear me down and it could be my excuse to be a fuck up and, you know, and everybody would probably understand and condone it. And,
yeah.
Or I could, you know, use this as a way to, you know, move forward and you know, be like my fuel to do well, succeed, whatever that is, and just, you know, not let it bring me down. And so I made a promise to myself that day on the beach there in Montsalon that I wasn't going to let it tear me down. I mean, I didn't really know what it was entail for me. I just knew that I was going to keep a positive aspect and a positive outlook. And I was just going to do my best to support my mom and my sisters. And, you know, one of the biggest things is I just didn't want to embarrass my family. And I didn't want to embarrass my dad's name. And even at that time, I was thinking about that. Like, you know, I didn't want to bring any more kind of negative light to the family. And so I just knew I needed to buckle down and just kind of start figuring things out step by step.
Did that pressure ever affect you negatively? Because that's a lot to put on yourself as a teenage kid.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, I had great friends. I had like six brothers that were still, you know, tied today, even though they live up there in the area and I don't, but, you know, they rallied around me. But, you know, it was one of those things where I look back, I didn't realize it at the time, but when I look back on it, as you know, I'm 41 now, and in the last year or two, I was looking back on that, and just, I was a kid, and unfortunately, I was drinking and partying and doing a lot of that stuff, and I was in college. I started went to community college. I didn't really, I was an athlete, but like, I just didn't really want to do anything at that point. I just wanted to stay home and, you know, just start slow and start with school. And so it was just, it was tough. So I shrouded a lot of those years in having a good time, quote unquote.
Yeah.
But that's probably what, you know, I was lucky to have come out of that, you know, and my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time when I met, you know, was real instrumental in kind of helping me, you know, move past that. But I got into, you know, a counseling years later, you know, a couple of years later, you know, my early 20s. But I think it really didn't start affecting me until after I got out of college and I kind of got on my own and you started realizing, you know, this is life, you know, and you got to kind of move forward with stuff. And so,
well, yeah, I mean, there's so many developmental things that could have been halted during that period,
right?
Because you're so busy, trying so hard not to fuck anything up,
right? Yeah, you're right.
I mean, and that's what everybody's trying to do already. But now you're dealing with this major grief after not really ever having to deal with anything like that. What was the discussion around mental health like in your house before that happened?
Zilch. Absolutely nothing. And you know what was crazy was my dad was also a Vietnam War vet, and he fought in the Tet Offensive and the Battle of Hue. He was a Marine, and so he saw he saw combat. It wasn't like he was somewhere safe and not doing much. And so he never talked about it, and nobody my mom had told stories when he first did come back about him, being real jumpy when they drive over the mountain passes into Seattle. Cause it was, he would go from things where you could see, 15 miles, and then all of a sudden you were into a bunch of redwoods and all around you. And his eyes were in that situation, would be darting around looking for snipers in the trees and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So he, but there wasn't like a talk about it later on in life, or like in my life or anybody like that, cause it just wasn't, nobody was sad or mopey about it. But, in hindsight, I look back on it now and, he was still struggling.
Yeah. Just stoicism.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
A lot of those guys, came back with forms of PTSD that went largely undiagnosed.
Absolutely.
A lot of those guys got a real raw deal.
I agree, 100%.
And the way that society would talk about people and treat people in that time period, there's no way you'd come forward and say that you're having a problem, because it was a whole different world.
Right. Well, and he came from that tough football, you just spit on your wounds and things like that.
Yeah, rub some dirt on it. Walk it off.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so it was, mental health wasn't something that was ever discussed. And it was, I look on it now and it's a lot different growing up now where, we're having discussions with my daughters. I have two daughters, 8 and 10 years old now. And my wife and I are real conscious of their mental health. And we've already kind of let them have, one of them is a little bit more sensitive than the other. And we're kind of noticing some things, that anxiety wise that, giving them a day if they just don't need it to go to school because they're mentally just, fried for whatever reason. And that's just the stuff that didn't happen in the 80s or the 90s.
No, of course not. Yeah, so. I'm getting pretty much the same thing with my kids. You kind of notice that something's developing. But, right. I mean, you've got a personal relationship with seeing something go untalked about and go wrong, and so you've got a stake in this, right. To figure it out. And I think that a lot of people, because we're about the same age, so a lot of people from our generation started to kind of figure it out.
Yeah. No, you're right. We're kind of in that that gap between Gen X and millennials, or whatever. We kind of got a good mix of both, and even. In my life, I don't think it really started becoming things until probably in my early 20s or mid-20s. And even then, it wasn't, not like it is today. It's a lot more open today. And kind of a lot of the reason why I'm stepping forward and, wanting to talk about my story and tell my story a little bit and, try to give some people some pathway, some looks at things and understanding that, when they have those discussions and they're making that life important choice of, am I going to let this crush me or am I going to move forward? They can see that that's a common thought. People have those thoughts and they can be successful on the other side.
So, I mean, what was your first foray into deciding that you were going to take these things and start trying to utilize them for you rather than against you?
I started to realize I first got involved into kind of some counseling in my mid-20s or early 20s when my wife came in my life and she started kind of seeing, she heard about my story, I told her about it, and she kind of was seeing things from a different perspective, and she wasn't clouded by knowing my family beforehand or any of that type of stuff. And so She got me to kind of go into counseling and take on some of those, you know, aspects that would bother me. You know, I was more confused at that time in my life than I ever was. And I was in my career, so to speak, but, you know, I needed a male figure to talk to, and I just was struggling with that. So I had to find some coping mechanisms. And in that one particular way is I started developing I had access to a lot of mentors that I didn't realize their importance until later on. But I started kind of developing some mentor relationships with other, you know, guys and stuff like that. But and that was in my late 20s. But, you know, I can really tell you that I came to what I call the power of the 3 P or 4 P's in my life, or the principles of pursuit. When I was just recently, when I was going through probably the second worst thing I'd ever gone through in my life. And that was the failure of my business and taking that into bankruptcy. And I just started realizing that, you know, positivity, persistence, perseverance, and patience were going to take me through this. And that's essentially what took me through, you know, the grief of my father to the point of being, you know, successful in business and in my career at one point. So I leaned on those 4 P's really hard while I was, you know, rebuilding my company and starting over from scratch.
Do you think that the years that you spent kind of trying to hold everything together was almost, in a way, repeating the stoicism of your father?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. He was, and he always wanted to make people happy around him. You know, he was never, he was a very generous guy, and he didn't like people being, you know, upset or whatever. So I kind of found that I was making other people happy, not really myself.
Yeah.
And kind of just making everybody realize I'm okay. Because everybody was so worried about me, you know, I was like, I'm okay.
Right. Got this.
You know, so I kind of developed that, you know,
you're fixing.
Yeah.
You're going to just absolutely make sure everything is all right for everybody.
Right. Right. Problem solver. I mean, it's what I do in my profession, and it's what, you know, he did largely as a, you know, a father.
Yeah.
And so, it's really interesting to look back and see, kind of all the stuff that naturally I had in me, and then how I kind of twisted it or turned it into a positive, you know, it was weird.
Yeah. Yeah, because every behavior can be something that you can use to your advantage if you tweak it right.
Right.
You know, like that ability to be able to focus on everything that's going on around you and people please can work negatively against you, but it can also make you very perceptive of what's happening with other people and give you a lot of empathy.
And to be honest with you, until recently, I keep talking about recently because within the last 5 years was when I've, you know, gone. The last 4 years have been really tough rebuilding my business, you know, filing bankruptcy and all this stuff, you know, and having to come out of that. But I realized that my true superpower, I was doing a lot of self-awareness. I was just really looking at myself like, you know, who are you? What are you doing? What's your gift? You know, what is it that you give or that you're able to do better than others, or you know what is that? And I realized that it was really something that I had considered a weakness for years was actually truly my strength, and that was my empathy.
Yes.
My empathy, I always thought, was a bad thing because it made me a pussy, or I was,
right,
you know, weak or whatever, you know. But, you know, I started realizing that my empathy was actually, you know, my superpower. And it allowed me to empathize with my clients. I was really able to put myself in other people's shoes and kind of see their perspective of things. And, you know, especially when it came to, you know, death, grief, and, you know, especially suicide. You know, we've had a lot of, you know, big name people, you know, take their own lives here in the last, you know, few years. And every time that happens, my first thought is to their families.
Yeah.
First thought. You know, and those, their kids, I think about their kids, and, you know, never met them, but I'm crying for them because their journey is just starting, you know, and they got such a long road ahead of them, and I just hurt for them.
Yeah,
you know, completely. I feel that pain. So, yeah, I would say empathy is just really the one that, you know, jumps out at me.
Well, take me back a little bit to an earlier part of this journey. I'm curious how it started when you started to build this business in the first place.
So I had been down in the Bay Area working in the transportation and logistics industry for a few years, about four or five years. And I had just kind of been really wondering, you know, if this is what I wanted to do the rest of my life. And I had originally thought after college I was going to go to law school, but I wanted to get a real job and, you know, kind of try that out, doing the 9-to-5 thing and, you know, all that. And so I had put it off. Well, at this point, I had kind of burned myself out in the industry, and I didn't like working for others, but it never really occurred to me that, you know, I could start my own business or be an entrepreneur. And when I decided I was going to go back to school, I was going to go at night and do night school and work during the day, because by then I was looking to get married to my wife, or my girlfriend at the time, my wife now. And you know, I just needed the money. It was expensive to live in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And already had some, you know, student loans and things like that. So I talked to my, one of my mentors in the business I was working for at the time, if he had a problem with me taking, you know, one of my clients, which was a bigger client, and trying to, you know, start my own thing and working by day, you know, doing that stuff. And then by night going to law school. And, you know, he supported that and was, you know, very well received. I mean, he could have said no. I mean,
yeah, that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And he was an intimidating guy. I mean, he was a big Brazilian Palestinian dude. And he I respected him, but he was kind of, you know, he was gruff and things like that. But he was a great guy. And, you know, he was able to understand that I was really wanting to do law school. I really wasn't wanting to blow up, you know, and do things in the logistics field on my own. It turned out that way, but at the time, you know, it wasn't like that. I just realized when I was sitting in class in law school those years that I did 1 year, and after that first year, the hardest year too, I realized that it wasn't that I didn't want to be an attorney. I just wanted to get my law degree so I could, you know, further get into other careers with negotiating and deal making. You know, that's essentially what I like to do. But I was making so much money doing what I was doing half, you know, my own business, like right, part time, than I would have been as a lawyer doing some of those other jobs. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll just, you know, quit this law thing and just double down on starting my own firm and see where that takes me. And so that's what I did. You know, my wife supported me, and she said, yeah, I mean, it was money down the drain essentially, because I, you know, it was law or loans that we took out for me to go back. And yeah, so it was like, oh shoot, we're just eating that. But you know, I just buckled down, and I really started, I wanted to teach, and I think that kind of came from my mom. And I brought some people in and kind of taught them the business. And you know, 4 or 5 years, we had a lot of success. I mean, that was going through like 2009. So we sailed through that recession and everything.
Yeah.
No problem. We were growing during it and things were great. But, you know, I came into headwinds again after that. But
so where does it go from there?
So I started, you know, kind of flattening out a little bit. And so I realized that I had to take a hard look at my business and just see, you know, what was not allowed. We were making less money. We weren't growing, but I was adding more people because we were busier than ever. And I realized that my biggest client was really holding us back because they were sucking all of our energy. We were trying to keep them happy. And I essentially had to make a decision on whether or not we kept them as a client in order to, you know, grow the business. But if I stepped out of that relationship, it was going to trigger all kinds of lawsuits and things like that. But I knew it would eventually bankrupt the company. And so I was going to have to start over from scratch, like literal scratch, if I did that. And I had my girls were young at the time. My youngest was three and five. So they weren't, you know, too much older than they were now. But, I just realized if I was going to do it, I had to do it now. if they were going to be, you know, I was going to try to do that at 12 and 15 and stuff like that, it was going to have a bigger impact on the family. But if I started from scratch right now, they could possibly not even notice it. And so that's what I did. You know, I took my top three guys out of my business and I told them, hey, look, we're firing our biggest client. I'm taking you three and we're starting over. I laid off the other seven people in my company and we started from zero and started building again. And this time we did it as a more broad approach and working with other entrepreneurs and smaller companies who we empathize with, and they empathized, you know, we were able to build really good relationships, strong relationships that way. And, you know, we were looking long-term as bad as we wanted it overnight. We weren't looking for, you know, huge clients that were going to get us money right away. We were looking at clients that would over time grow and we would grow with them. And essentially that was what our business model was, and it worked. You know, we're 5 years in it now and we're way past where we were ever at before, and just recently got announced that we're one of Inc. magazine's fastest growing companies in America. And you know, just a lot of, you know, cool things are happening now, but it took a lot of just buckling down and shouldering a lot of stress.
Yeah.
And uncertainty.
How do you manage something like that? Because that's a lot to go through, especially when you're in charge of the livelihood of other people and having to make big decisions like that. How do you manage that for yourself personally?
A lot of self-awareness. I mean, I really, I put myself to the grinder on, like, you know, who I am and what I am and, you know, just trying to really figure it out. And it was a day by day thing. But I started drawing on how I survived, you know, getting to that point in the first place. And I looked back from the day that I found out about my dad and how I'd gotten through college in 4 years after that. You know, I really was picking up a lot of steam after that happened because I really just put a lot on my shoulders and I was going to just grind through it. And that's when I really realized the strength of what I had accomplished. Growing, you know, going through that stuff with my dad, you know, my wife was another story. You know, she was just, you know, it was hard for her. It was very hard for her, as it would be most people. And so I realized my adversity tolerance was a little bit higher than, you know, a lot of other people.
Right.
So I just, you know, I bore down. I had a long-term plan and I just had a lot of short-term goals. And we just, you know, focused on those day by day. And just kept our head down and just kept grinding. And, you know, and also one of the things within 6 months of that new business, we lost one of our biggest clients during that first 6 months too. So that was an early setback in that whole rebound or comeback that we easily could have succumbed to. But I was just so focused I could take it at that time, you know.
Well, so, when you've lived through something that you can't even imagine living through.
Right.
And you come
like
out
the worst that already happened.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly that. The worst thing that you could even think of. You came out the other side of it, and one morning you had to take a shower, you had to shave your face and wash your hair and go to work and figure shit out because you have people counting on you, you have yourself counting on you.
Yep.
You have the memory of your father in your head and you have all of these things that you thought could easily take you out. And instead, you get up and you move. So, of course, your tolerance is going to be a lot higher than a lot of other people because you've seen the pit.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, and it's not like it was I jumped out of bed every morning.
No,
you know,
of course not.
I would just click my heels and was ready to head to work. I mean, I had to pull myself out of bed and get there. And, you know, I mean, it was arduous. And so I think that's, you know, the misperception people have is like just because you're moving forward doesn't mean it has to be great. You know, and all, you know, you just have to, like you said, get up and, you know, make those little movements. Like for me, it was making the bed. If I got up every morning and was able to make the bed, then that was the first goal was accomplished for the day. And then I could kind of keep going after that.
Yeah.
And I've heard that since, you know, I think there was a military guy that did a motivational speech about that, but it's so true. It's such a simple act, but it's your first foot forward.
Yeah. I mean, you're putting an intention out into the world, however you want to look at that. It's the idea of, starting the day off by saying, I can do this.
Right. And I think that really goes back to your mindset, and the mindset that I was developing was my intent. You know, what's my intent? My intent is to be kind, to be good, and to be good at what I do. And as long as I, you know, I set my intent, then everybody around me kind of knows it, that, you know, myself, I know it. We're all moving forward in one direction in the same way. And they can forgive me for being a dick one day or whatever, because my intention overall is actually good. It's just that I was having a bad day, you know.
But where did you first start getting your external tools from? Did you read books, or did you see a therapist, or?
You know, it was therapists. It was reading things. You know, also one of the interesting stuff was when I was growing up, there wasn't the resources available that there is like online, you know, now. So I developed a lot of it really just by surviving. I mean, they came out of the survival mechanism, and you know, I say you survive and thrive. You know, that's all you got to do. Is the first thing you got to do is just survive, and then you can figure out how to thrive over that time. And that's essentially what I did. And then I started finding things online that were validating and putting a name to things that I had never thought were normal, like other people had experienced or anything like that. So I found a lot online with people like an entrepreneur named Gary Vaynerchuk. Mm-hmm. Who are some other guys that, I mean, even Tony Robbins to some extent.
Sure.
They were just kind of confirming some of these things and processes and putting names to things that I had done and kind of just developed on my own as a coping mechanism. I would like to say I learned it from books and shit like that, but I didn't, I mean, really read too many about it. I read more of them now about it just because I feel like now there's some validation that maybe I can use these to help other people. You know, maybe I can articulate it to them in a way that they get it, that I didn't at that time.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it is a process. I mean, you're going to pick some things up from somewhere. And the fact that you were able to, you know, get some things from various places, but that's not to discount the fact that you did have, you know, a level of clarity within yourself to begin with, that you were able to start kind of, you know, taking these things and you're on a razor's edge with all of your decisions at all times.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. And so that thought that you could most of the time step on the right side of the line and say, this is probably the right choice.
Right.
That's not nothing.
You're developing those gut instincts, you know?
Yes.
I have a thing on my phone that even to this day on my lock screen that says, trust your instincts. You know, and it's just a reminder to me to trust, you know, what's gotten me here and to not question them anymore. I mean, I'd question it more when I was younger, but now it's like I've gone through it twice that usually my gut is probably telling me, you know, the right thing to do. But yeah, you're right. It's just, it just comes kind of with doing.
Yeah.
And being in a positive mindset.
You know, as we're winding down here, I want to do something a little bit different at the end here. And I was wondering if you would tell me a really good story about your dad. It doesn't have to be important. It can just be a good day. You know what I mean? Something that makes you happy.
Yeah. You know, there was one that it was actually an important message, and it kind of really goes back to the empathy that I was talking about, and, you know, it really came from him. But when I was a kid, going out places with my father, everybody knew him. He knew everybody. You know, going to the grocery store for milk would turn into a 2-hour ordeal. And, you know, so as a kid, I grew up with everybody being kind of attracted, you know, coming up to my dad and, you know, talking with him, and my dad doing the same. And I had mentioned he worked for a government contracting company that basically, so the plutonium for the atom bomb, the nuclear bomb or whatever that they dropped in Hiroshima was developed in my hometown. And it was actually, the whole town was born out of the Manhattan Project and, you know, building device. And so we had a lot of scientists, a lot of doctors, PhDs, yeah. things like that, that were in the community. And those were the type of people that my dad, you know, dealt with on a regular basis. And we were in a candy store one day in the mall, and this guy came up to my dad, and he was really excited to see my dad. And I could tell right away he was kind of a little nerdy, you know. And I was at that age where, you know, everything's cool or not cool, you know. And I kind of just sat there and whatever. And but my dad acted like he was his best friend and had seen him a while, took the time to, you know, talk to, you know, just was really just great with this guy. And this guy meant a lot to him.
Yeah.
You know, this guy. And people looked up to my dad. And so my dad just had this way of making people feel really good. And we left the store. We were walking through the mall, and I kind of made a comment about, you know, what are you talking to that dork for? Or something like that. You know right. what I mean? Like,
yeah.
stupid comment that a 13-year-old would make. And he stopped me in the mall. He stopped me there right in my tracks. And he got down on my level, and he explained to me that we all put our pants on one leg at a time. And that nobody, you're no better than anybody else, and nobody else is better than you. And you just remember that. You treat everybody the same way you'd want to be treated. And it just really, like, it hit home. And it was something I've never forgotten. I mean, like I said, I was probably like 12 at the time. And I can, as I'm telling the story, I can visually see his eyes. And just, like, you know, how serious he was about it, you know. And I just kind of always carried that with me, you know, that everybody has their own stories. Everybody has their own battles that they're fighting. And if we're not kind to one another, then, you know, what are we doing this for? You know,
yeah.
it just makes it harder. So it's just something that I try every day to be, you know, open and, you know, understanding and just try to be helpful. And we need more kindness. And you know, I want kindness to, I viewed it as such as like a sissy type of thing when I was younger. And, you know, or like not a sissy, but just kind of like, you don't want to be too kind. You don't want to be taken advantage of, things like that. So you kind of build this wall around it. And,
yeah.
you know, it's just,
it's not cool to be nice.
Right, right, right. So I think that's something that I want. There's a lot of people, you know, like I mentioned Gary Vaynerchuk. I want to make those alpha male traits. My dad was an alpha male.
Yeah.
You know, and for him to be able to really take the time and just really, and he knew everybody's kids' names. I mean, he was great with that type of stuff. And I wish I was better at it. But, yeah, it's just, we've all got our own challenges that we're fighting, and you don't know anything about it. And the key about it, I mean, that ultimately came true with him. Nobody knew the battles that he was fighting in his own head, not even his own family. And you just never know.
It's beautiful that you have that great, great memory. I mean, that's an excellent lesson for anybody to have.
Right. And the fact that he took it as a parent now, I think about it too. It was really interesting because I feel almost closer to him now than I have in the last few years because I'm hearing him all the time as I'm talking to my girls, you know, like things that are coming from just my just in my head somewhere, you know.
Yeah.
They sound like him. And so I start thinking about, you know, what he was thinking, you know, during those times and, you know, how he was coming about stuff. And for, you know, to take the time to make sure that I understood that, and that was important. It wasn't just, you know, we wanted to get that straight. I mean, I thought I was going to get grounded, you know. But,
yeah.
So it was a real eye-opener. And, you know, he enjoyed people and I, you know, enjoy people. And, you know, he had a wide swath of, you know, different types of individuals and that he was friends with, and you know, that's kind of how I am. And you know, it's a good thing to do. You gotta have some variety in life.
Absolutely. You know, it's kind of interesting that relationship that a lot of people have with their parents when they, as you know, especially I can kind of relate in that sense. You know, I always had a pretty close relationship with my dad, and it was one of those things where I'll never forget the day that I realized he was just a guy.
Like, oh yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, I think it was, he was trying to figure out how his phone worked, you know,
and right.
It was like, oh, okay. Yeah. He's just a guy who lived a life and tried to figure things out and, you know, not yep. fuck things up as best as he could.
Right.
And he still did sometimes. And it somehow kind of made him a lot more interesting.
More relatable, make it more, relatable almost, maybe.
It's like once he wasn't mythic anymore.
Right.
There was something sort of special about that. And it sounds like you kind of have some of that now, too, now that you're a father. And being able to have that recognition, even though he's gone, in a way, there are still things that are coming out that are reminding you of him that you're still learning.
Right, right. You know, and that's the thing is, you know, you have a tendency to kind of mythologize or, you know, people when they die and things like that, and all they did was everything was great. And you kind of forget that they were human and they did have faults and there were things that they didn't do right. And, or what they were just doing the best that they could at that time. And I think that's why I understand it so much more now as being a father, you know, of what a challenge that is. And then to also, you know, from where he came from too, you know, like he grew up without his dad. His dad wasn't in his life. And, he didn't have any kind of, you know, guidance in that direction as far as how to be a man. You know, I had some other mentors and coaches and things that did fill that role and help move forward. But he taught me so much in the 18 years that he was alive that I would be a fool not to take that and try to use that stuff moving forward when he had none of that. And he became the first to get a college degree in his family. And, you know, he had a great middle class, you know, life with his, you know, with great family and wife and all that stuff. So he didn't have a fifth or a third or an inkling of those tools that I had been given by him. And so it would be a double travesty for me not to be able to, you know, use those to help move him forward.
Well, I'm really glad that you shared a lot of that story with me today. And a lot of your story, because I think this is really going to, I think it's really going to resonate with a lot of people.
Well, and that's what I hope. You know, I've been quiet about a lot of this for a long time, but I'm at a point in my life now where, you know, I kind of feel like I could maybe be of some help, you know, and it's, especially where, you know, this is such a on point topic in today's society. And, just mental health and, you know, suicide and things like that. And it's a real ripple effect that happens in a family. And it's not about just the one person that, you know, and their one bad decision. It's, there's a lot that goes behind it. So I hope that, you know, somebody can take some of what I said and apply it, or, you know, just validate their feelings. If anything, I think that was the biggest thing for me, is that somebody else was feeling the same way I was feeling.
Yeah. And the worst day of your life, you know, there's still more days after that.
Right. Right. There's tomorrow, and, you know, you're not guaranteed anything other than today, you know, and I started, really focusing on the present and trying to be more present, you know, and in my life. And, you know, it's just, it can all, and enjoying everybody around me. I hate having things being unresolved or issues being unresolved, because you just never know.
Yeah.
You never know. So.
Well, thanks for talking to me today.
No problem. I really appreciate it. Thanks for giving me the opportunity. And, you know, I hope, like I said, that this will resonate with someone out there.
Well, it certainly resonates with me. If you want to find Tyson, and I know you do, you can find him at the links provided in the feed below. As for me, please come out to the Buntport Theater in Denver, Colorado, Monday, October 21st, for the We Still Like You show. It's stories that people shouldn't probably tell, but they do, and the audience still likes them even after they've shared it. It's a great show for a great cause, which is honestly just making me feel better about being weird. So if you could help me do that, I'd greatly appreciate it. But that's all I got for you this week, everybody. Another show coming up next week. And as always, don't kill yourselves out there.